It is Friday, July the 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, U.S. lawmakers reviewing that Iran nuclear deal, but does it matter what they think?
Even if the United States Congress gets sufficient number of votes on the Democratic side, the president has already gone to the U.N. Security Council, which unanimously supported the deal.
Also ahead, President Obama beginning his trip to Africa, plus our immigrant series today, an entrepreneur from Burkina Faso. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Good to have you with us. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry mounted a strong defense of that international deal to curb Iran's nuclear weapons during a contentious Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing yesterday. Mr. Kerry came under attack after a number of Republican senators who he said had been fleeced and bamboozled, deceived by Iran. Secretary Kerry was joined in defending the deal by two of his key architects, Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz and Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew. VOA's Cindy Sain reporting now on a dramatic day of testimony on Capitol Hill.
Secretary of State John Kerry got a warm response from pacifist Code Pink activists as the hearing began. But the Iran deal he worked so hard to forge soon came under attack, starting with Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman Bob Corker.
But what I think you've actually done in these negotiations is codify a perfectly aligned pathway for Iran to get a nuclear weapon just by abiding by this agreement.
Kerry countered, saying that whether the rest of the world likes it or not, Iran has already developed a sophisticated nuclear program.
They have developed the ability to produce the fissile material for bomb. And we can't bomb that knowledge away.
Kerry said the only viable option is to subject Iran to vigorous international inspections, as laid out in the agreement. Some Democrats, like ranking committee member Ben Cardin, praised Kerry for bringing the major world powers together on Iran and keeping them together.
And looking at the final agreements that we've gotten today, and our negotiators got an awful lot.
But most Republicans strongly criticized the deal, including Senator and presidential candidate Marco Rubio.
The Iranian regime and the world should know that the majority of members of this Congress do not support this deal, and that the deal could go away on the day President Obama leaves office.
Another Republican senator and presidential candidate, Ted Cruz, held a rally against the deal at a park in front of the White House Thursday, saying President Barack Obama capitulated to Iran. Cruz was interrupted by Code Pink protesters.
We run tech! We run tech!
White House spokesman Josh Earnest dismissed the small rally as a pro-war demonstration. Congress has 60 days to review the Iran deal and may vote to approve or reject it in September. Cindy Sain, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
In Saudi Arabia this week, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter said he secured Saudi support for this Iran nuclear agreement with some reservations and verification for future sanctions. Saudi Arabia, which is a regional rival of Iran, had made no public pronouncements about that agreement. But Rand Corporation senior political scientist Rick Brennan told VOA's Victor Beatty, Riyadh is taking the long view on its security relationship with the U.S.
The security relationship with the United States is critical, not only for the security of Saudi Arabia, but also for the entire Gulf area. And so while Carter came out and said that the Saudis approved the Iran nuclear deal, I think it was more along the lines that they didn't voice any strong objections to their concerns over the international inspectors to verify that Iran was complying with the deal, and if it wasn't, to be able to snap back the provisions. Given the way that the Arab culture is and the way they deal with U.S. diplomats in that region, it doesn't surprise me that they didn't come out very strongly opposing a deal that the United States had already entered. It would be counterproductive for them to do so.
How likely is a nuclear arms race in the Middle East given this deal?
I think the nuclear arms race has already begun.
This will likely give the Saudis incentives to continue. There have been ample news reports of the Saudis already dealing with the Pakistanis to counter this effect. So I think we're going to see a real potential in the future if Iran starts cheating on this deal, which most observers believe they probably will, that over the objections of the United States, the Saudis will probably start to try to find other ways to provide their security to protect them in the event that the Iranians develop a breakthrough capacity in the next several years.
Rick, of course, the debate in Congress on the nuclear deal is already underway. The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, Wednesday expressed deep skepticism, saying, quote, because a bad deal threatens the security of the American people, we're going to do everything possible to stop it. Even though Republicans control both houses of Congress, isn't this really a matter of how many Democrats will vote with and against the president?
It's even worse than that, because even if the United States Congress gets sufficient number of votes on the Democratic side, the president has already gone to the U.N. Security Council, which unanimously supported the deal. So for all intents and purposes, going to Congress at this point is little more than going through the motions of asking for congressional support. The agreement's been signed. The Security Council's approved it, and as long as the Iranians continue to march down the road and fulfill the short-term agreements within the next 90 days, this is going to be in place as international law and international policy, regardless of what the U.S. Congress says.
That is RAND Corporation senior political scientist Rick Brennan. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. Brennan also said he agrees with Iran's spiritual leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who says Iran and American interests in the Middle East are not similar. Brennan says that while many American policymakers in both the major political parties fail to realize that Iran, since the creation of the Islamic Republic in 1979, has been at war with the U.S. and has been indirectly responsible for thousands of American casualties. It is time now to see what's being said on social media about that Iran nuclear deal. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here with us now about what people are saying online. Hello, G.
Hi, Steve. Let's begin with Secretary Kerry's tweet. Wednesday night, he shared a Washington Post article he wrote with Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz. He wrote, "The Iran deal is the only durable, viable option to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon." He included the article's link in the tweet, and that's been retweeted about 200 times.
I see, Gene. Has Mr. Moniz been tweeting also?
He has. He tweeted, "Congress should judge the Iran deal on its scientific and technical parameters. I'm confident they block every pathway to a nuclear weapon." He's on Twitter at Ernest Moniz, and that's spelled M-O-N-I-Z. But more interesting than today's tweet perhaps is the one that's been pinned, which means that tweet shows up on top of his page. Mr. Moniz wrote on July 14th, "The Iran deal is based on hard science. Our nuclear experts and national labs helped shape the negotiations with rigorous technical analysis." That tweet has been retweeted more than 700 times.
And tell us about how hashtag Iran deal is being used. Is it still a widely used hashtag?
Well, Steve, I would say it's getting a steady flow of attention. The formal name for the Iran deal, as you know, is a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which was signed in Vienna on July 14th. If you look at the social media analytics website, Topsy, the use of hashtag Iran deal became more frequent since the 12th and exponentially rose on the next day. More than 200,000 tweets used that hashtag on the 14th, the day of the announcement, and since the 15th, that hashtag was used around 25,000 times a day on average. Steve?
And many thanks to you, G. That is G. Abby Lee. She is our social media guru. By the way, if you'd like to follow G on Twitter, her handle is at G. Abby Lee. You can also follow VOA's International Edition on Twitter. You can find us at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us. Also in the news, U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter made a previously unannounced visit to Baghdad on Thursday as Iraqi forces prepared an assault on militants holding Ramadi, a key stronghold of the Islamic State group and the regional capital. You know, this comes amid continued fighting in nearby Fallujah, and Islamic State is claiming it was responsible for a deadly suicide car bombing this week in the Iraqi capital. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more now from our Middle East Bureau.
As U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter met with Iraqi officials, a video on his Facebook page announced his visit.
Hi, everybody. It's SecDef Ash Carter. I've been in the Middle East for 3 days now, and I've met with a lot of important people.
Questions mounted in the comments on his page, many from Iraqis wanting to know if or when the United States is going to help Iraq defeat the self-proclaimed Islamic State, known as ISIS or ISIL, which has held massive territories in Syria and Iraq for over a year. In a Wednesday briefing released to the public Thursday, Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren said Carter is visiting Iraq to see what the U.S. can do to improve the security situation. The next major move for the Iraqi government, supported by a U.S.-led coalition, is the retaking of Ramadi, a strategic city held by ISIS, says Warren.
Iraqi security forces are positioning themselves in various locations around Ramadi in an ascent to place a noose around the city and isolate it from being supported by other Daesh forces, by other ISIL forces, and to prevent the enemy from escaping.
He says between 1,000 and 2,000 militants are believed to be holding Ramadi, but that their supply lines are being cut off by Iraqi troops. Meanwhile, the Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for a suicide car bombing that killed 20 people in Baghdad on Wednesday, and fighting continued in Fallujah, a major city on the road between Baghdad and Ramadi.
Fallujah now تعد من وجهة نظر الحكومة والمؤسسة الأمنية العراقية.
Iraqi political analyst Ali Hussein says there is a weapons factory in Fallujah, and the city is believed to be a recruitment center for Islamic State fighters. Warren says part of the Ramadi operation includes the ongoing battle for Fallujah that began last week.
If you can fix the enemy in Fallujah, which is only 15, 20 miles away, if you can fix the enemy in Fallujah, prevent that enemy from being able to support enemy forces in Ramadi, then it makes the task of seizing Ramadi easier.
He says the battle for Ramadi will begin within the next 2 months, if all goes as planned, and involve thousands of Iraqi soldiers battling not just ISIS, but brutally hot weather with temperatures approaching 49 degrees Celsius. In a later Facebook post, Defense Secretary Carter says he observed forces training in Iraq that he hopes will take back their country. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Cairo.
President Obama has left the United States for a trip to Ethiopia and Kenya, which, by the way, is the homeland of his father. All of this as he highlights growth in American economic links with sub-Saharan Africa. He's scheduled to arrive later today in Kenya, where he will attend the Global Entrepreneurship Summit in Nairobi. Later, he will become the first American president to visit Ethiopia. Meantime, Kenya's foreign secretary says the Obama visit is a strong endorsement for his country and hopes it will lead to greater investment. Gabe Joslow has highlights from the secretary's interview with VOA.
In an interview with VOA's Vincent McCorry in Nairobi Thursday, Cabinet Secretary Amina Mohamed said President Obama's visit with the government shines a positive light on Kenya and the administration of President Uhuru Kenyatta.
I think it's his coming now is just recognition of the kind of leadership that we have, a pragmatic, energetic, passionate, driven leadership, but also a recognition of what Kenya has been able to achieve in the last few years.
Kenya's relations with the United States have been strained at times, especially when President Kenyatta and his deputy William Ruto were facing charges at the International Criminal Court for their alleged roles in violence that followed the 2007 presidential election. But now, the tensions appear to be in the past. Mr. Obama is expected to arrive in Kenya on Friday to co-host with Kenya a global entrepreneurship summit. With business leaders from around the world coming in for the meeting, Mohammed says she hopes to see some new investments in Kenya.
Everything is on the table. We're hoping, again, that a lot of investment will flow in. You know, we are taking center stage because the U.S. president is coming. I think everybody is interested in knowing what is in this country that is being visited and what can this country offer.
Aside from trade, another major issue on the agenda during Mr. Obama's visit is the state of security. Kenya, which shares a border with Somalia, has been repeatedly targeted by the Somali-based militant group Al-Shabaab. Mohammed said the U.S. has remained a strong partner to Kenya in the fight against terrorism.
Our collaboration, especially on security, is historic. It's been there. Of course, we've enhanced it a lot in the last few years because of the threat, the global threat, actually, that we all face. You know, insecurity is not unique to this part of the world.
Kenya has also played a role mediating regional crises, including the dispute in Burundi over the president's controversial bid for a third term in office. Burundi is still counting the votes from the presidential election held Tuesday, and Mohammed said regional leaders are still considering whether or not to accept the results.
There is talk about not recognizing the election results. We're consulting with the African Union, we're consulting with the East African community to see what the way forward is, and to get ourselves out of the fog.
Mohammed also said she is hopeful for a resolution soon to the crisis in South Sudan, where a political dispute between two rival leaders sparked a civil war that has left thousands dead and has displaced more than 2 million others. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And you'll be able to follow President Obama's visit to Africa at our website, voanews.com. Now we turn our attention to International Edition's Adam Phillips, here for another of his ongoing series of interviews with immigrants to the U.S. Adam speaks here with my colleague Susan Yaki about this week's immigrant interview.
Today we're going to meet Khadija Kabore Lamport. She came to New York from Burkina Faso, West Africa, 13 years ago, and is really making a go of it, selling homemade cosmetics and cream made from shea butter. Now, shea is a fat made from the nut of the shea tree, which grows only in Africa, and it's been used for centuries as a skin beautifier and as an anti-inflammatory balm. We were standing in her kitchen while she mixed up a batch, and she told me her business, Khadija Handmade, is finally starting to take off, but it has been a bit of a slog.
I thought it was easy to just start the business, but I realized it was difficult because I have to like meet all the demands, and just to talk to the customer about the products also, it's something that I wasn't thinking of. I was like, oh, it was easy. I just make it and I just sell it, and it's not what I was thinking. A lot of people are unfamiliar with shea. They don't know the different quality of the shea butter. There's many quality of shea butter, never yellow. If it's yellow, it got mixed with palm oil. That's not a good shea butter for me. I buy the fat and bring them here in New York City and then make them on my own with my own ingredient. Just to smell it, it just reminds me of my childhood, and I'm happy.
Do you have any advice for people who are coming here from other places who would hear this, either back home or other places in the world? Any advice that you would have for other immigrants?
I would say before you come over, just do your homework, because it is hard when you get here and you don't know what to do. Sometimes you have some idea, but it's not the same. Sometimes we watch the movies, we read the books, and make us think like, oh my God, this is the end of the world. You know, I can just come in, I just work, and I earn a lot of money. But this is not the case.
What is the case?
When you get here, first of all, you have to find where to live, and you need a paperwork to be able to find a job. Even if you have a papers, it's hard to find a job. So it's not easy. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult.
Do you ever want to just go back home and live?
At some point, yes. The culture, it's completely different. I will say in my hometown, everybody's open, inviting, and everybody say hello to anybody you don't know. You can even invite someone you met down the street to come over for drink or for dinner and all that. And I realize in American, it is different. Everything is private. Even your friend with them, but you they still have their privacy you have to respect.
It can be lonesome.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say?
I would like to say, I'm very happy and proud to be here in the United States because it's land of an opportunity, and I'm working on my share business, and hopefully I will make my dream come true.
We all hope our American dreams come true.
Me too, Susan. Khadija is a real American entrepreneur, West African style. I have no doubt at all she's going to succeed.
And it certainly sounds like it. VOA's Adam Phillips in New York for International Edition, speaking with my colleague Susan Yaki.
This is BizBeat.
When the U.S. and the European Union imposed sanctions over Russia's annexation of Crimea, many Western firms decided to stop sending any kind of technology to Russia for fear of violating the sanctions. As a result, Russian scientists say they're getting shortchanged. For example, Artur Bilski, a scientist at the Institute of Thermophysics located in Siberia in an area known as Academy Town, says buying equipment from Japan in the past was doable. He says, when we asked about it last year, the Japanese turned down our request categorically. Also, on suspicion of Western influence, the Kremlin cut off funding for Russian scientists from the Dynasty Foundation, a large private source of money for researchers. The situation is different now, Bilski says. The challenge ahead for Russian scientists, to find other sources of funding. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. An online spat between pop superstars Taylor Swift and Nicki Minaj has ended. That's good news, I guess. High-profile conflict even involved pop stars such as Katy Perry and Rihanna. Well, International Edition's David Byrd spoke with VOA's Ray McDonald. He hosts the Top 5 Countdown about what happened and why it happened and how it ended.
She is considered one of the queens of pop music, but Taylor Swift was getting kind of in a bit of a tiff this week with Nicki Minaj. It all started over the Video Music Award nominations that came out earlier. Ray, what exactly, how did all of this start? How did this Twitter war start?
It all started humbly enough on July 21st, when Nicki Minaj said, hey, where's my Video of the Year nomination for Anaconda? And she felt that she'd been passed over, and she made a comment that the media seemed to have double standards when it comes to females, that African Americans were held to a different standard. They were shunted aside, put on an urban award shows, and that why wasn't she in the center stage? When white performers doing the same things got all the recognition. She didn't name any names.
My anaconda don't, my anaconda don't, my anaconda don't want none unless you got buns, hun.
Boy, toy named Troy used to live in Detroit. Big, 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 big money, he was getting some coins. Was the shootouts with the Lord, but he lived in a palace. Both bought me Alexander McQueen, he was keeping me.
Well, she did mention something about if you're a tall, thin, skinny woman in your video, then, you know, you'll get attention.
That caught Taylor's attention.
That's kind of what do they call that? It's not a direct tweet at somebody, but it's kind of an implied tweet because Taylor Swift and all of the women in her Bad Blood video, which was nominated, are tall and thin and, you know, runway model types. I don't get what Nicki's talking about with the urban thing, though, because Beyonce was one of the other nominees.
Well, of course. I mean, you can pick her claims apart. And this was, I think, an emotional response. And I think you can say that certain elements of her argument have merit and others maybe not so much.
Well, now, see, what also goes on here is other pop stars, Katy Perry and Rihanna, weighed in or started to weigh in on this thing. It went on for a few days. And then finally, Taylor Swift called a truce. She basically said, look, I misunderstood and my bad, so sorry, love you, you know, air kisses.
She and Nicki Minaj made up. Taylor said, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I spoke rashly and I apologize. And Nicki said, thank you, Taylor. That means so much. My respect for you has gone up. And like you say, peace seems to have been restored.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. You can hit him up at VOA underscore music. You can send me a tweet. I'm David_DBird. That's with a Y, not an I. And you can also send your messages to VOA underscore IE. If you love like that, blood runs cause baby, we got bad blood. You know, we used to be bad love. So take a look what you've done. Cause baby, now we got bad blood. Now we got problems. And I don't think we can solve.
It is definitely good to know that Nicki and Taylor have worked things out, huh? And did it on Twitter. Where else would you do it but on Twitter, huh? Another story for you. American actor Leonardo DiCaprio has raised $40 million, all of that to help save the planet. It was at an auction in Saint-Tropez, France. Of course, that's where I would do it. Second annual Leonardo DiCaprio Foundation fundraising gala included live auction, donated jewelry, artwork, even things from the actor's personal collection. Can you imagine? Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. A reminder, the top world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
On the night of September 11th, 2012, members of the Ansar al-Sharia terrorist group attacked two U.S. government facilities in Benghazi, Libya. Using machine guns, rocket-propelled grenades, and mortars, the militants targeted the U.S. Special Mission compound and a nearby annex in repeated assaults, killing four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador, wounding two more U.S. personnel, and three Libyan contract guards. Both facilities were destroyed. Rewards were offered, and an intensive search mounted for those responsible for the attack. On June 15th, U.S. military personnel arrested a key suspect in the operation, Ahmed Abu Katala, a senior leader of Ansar al-Sharia in Benghazi, has been charged with murder and other charges and will be sent to the United States to stand trial. Others involved in the attack remain at large, and the United States will do whatever it takes to see that justice is done. Created after the fall of Libya's longtime ruler, Muammar Gaddafi, Ansar al-Sharia has been involved in many attacks in the region, targeting civilians and assassinating or attempting to assassinate security officials and political actors in eastern Libya. Its members continue to pose a threat to U.S. interests in Libya and have been designated as international terrorist organizations. Toward this end, the Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of any individual responsible for the Benghazi attacks. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on any of these individuals, contact the Regional Security Office at the nearest U.S. Embassy or the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.